questions haunt every life, writes Andy Crouch. The first, what are we meant to be? The second, why are we so far from what we're meant to be? Hello and welcome to Restoring the Soul, a podcast dedicated to helping you close the gap from what you're meant to be and what keeps you from being all that. I'm your producer, Brian Beatty. Thank you for listening. On this edition of Restoring the Soul, we're featuring a conversation Michael had with Bill Thrall. If you're a leader in any capacity in your life, you're going to find great connection and value in this discussion. Bill's a co-founder of TrueFace, an organization committed to helping people experience authentic, trust-filled relationships by emphasizing the importance of humility, trust, and grace. His influence can also be experienced through books like The Cure, The Ascent of a Leader, Bo's Cafe, and High Trust Cultures. So let's pick up the discussion where Bill describes the early days of Leadership Catalyst.
And so at first, when we started working together, we were realizing three parts that we said are intricately woven together, and without all three, you can't make it. One is understanding humility, understanding relationships of trust, and creating environments of grace. If those three things, a safe place, if those three things are not in sync, failure is inevitable.
For the leader.
For the leader. And for those they influence.
And you define humility pretty differently. I love how you define it, but yeah, not beating yourself up or deprecating yourself.
No, I mean, one of the things that we do, I'm saying in a broad Christian sense, is that we have these virtues, Christian virtues. Humility is, quote, one of the Christian virtues. And you kind of have that scalp on your belt, so to speak. I got that one. And it's one of those virtues misunderstood in which I can't talk about it because it would ruin the fact that I am. So therefore, I can only be humble in silence, whatever that means. Well, the tragedy of that is it doesn't work. So we have what we call a relational definition of humility. It's trusting God and others with me. Every act of trust is an act of humility. But it comes with incredible promise. God gives grace to the humble. Now, as evangelicals, oh, grace, you know, I understand that. That's what saves me. You know, it's a big deal. I love grace. Oh, man, we know so little about the grace to live by. We know the grace that we're saved by. So that indispensable part is critical to the formation of a leader. It's like so many of the things Jesus teaches. They're like backwards to us. Sometimes we will, when we do a pastor's conference, I'm the one in my notes. I'm the one who gets asked these two questions. We just did this in Portland with a huge group of pastors. Here's the question I ask. How many of you have excellence as a value or virtue for your church? Don't raise your hands, but you just see them trying to get their hands up. I say, don't raise your hands. I have another question for you. How many of you have humility as a virtue or a value for your church? Not as many hands are going to go up. Then I'll say this to them. What if God doesn't want your excellence? What if God wants your humility so he can give you his excellence? And they just look at me like, you son of a gun, what are you doing to us? because we have been trapped into a mindset that God is really honored when we give him our best. But God is really honored when he lets us give him to us his best. That's when he's really honored.
Two very different things.
Mike, they're as different as night and day.
And you've already implied this, but it sounds to me like that's a whole new language for most pastors and leaders.
Yeah, it is. I think that's a good point to make. I think we're better at it now, 17 years later, 16 years later. We're better at it in terms of the language. But initially, our language was so us that people couldn't figure out, what, you guys, would you make this up? But over the years now, as we've, like we did our workshop even today, giving people the Bill Thrall one-liners, but basically now saturating those one-liners with scripture and understanding, And it's taken a while. I mean, I would say to you that back in the middle 80s to the early 90s, I don't think I had even a bit of an understanding that our perspective in grace was different than the majority. I wouldn't have known that then because I lived in my own little world. Hmm. It was only when we stepped out of our little world into the majority world mm-hmm. that people would say to us, what are you talking about? We talk about grace. One of the statements that we make is, for many evangelicals, grace is one of the theologies I believe. I have a theology of grace. I have a theology of family. I have a theology of relationships. I have a theology of God, and grace is one of my theologies. And we say, no, that's not a biblical perspective of grace. Grace is not one of our theologies. It is foundational to our theology. Hmm. If you put it in the foundation, it's a very different worldview. Extremely different.
A very important distinction, as you said, between grace that we're saved by and grace that we live by.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, it says in the scripture, as you have received Christ Jesus your Lord, so walk ye in him. The as there is the same. I mean, we may get terminology differences with evangelicals, but there are very few evangelicals that would not understand that in order to become a Christian, I had to trust God. Very few of them would. I mean, how else would you become a Christian?
Right,
so
right.
That's not a problem. I mean, what am I trusting God for? I'm trusting God through the blood of Jesus Christ to cleanse me of my sin and to give me eternal life. And that would be the evangelical message of the gospel.
Right.
Nobody's going to. I mean, very few are going to battle with that. But when you say, one of the miracles at a place called Calvary was that Jesus died for my sin. One of the miracles at a place called Calvary is that Jesus actually took upon him my shame. Hmm. One of the miracles at a place called Calvary is that Jesus made me new. Christian life is not about changing who I used to be into who I ought to be, which is the mantra of a majority of the church that doesn't understand grace. It's not about changing who I used to be into who I ought to be. It's about living out of who God says I am. That's the grace that's foundational to who we are as believers.
I definitely want to unpack that. Before we do, I want to go back to the definition of humility, of trusting God and others with me. What might that look like for your average senior pastor, CEO, or leader of influence? What does that look like?
Well, I'll answer that, but I'll tell you a little story in opening it. Sometimes I'll be asked to come alongside, as I am often, not sometimes, to come alongside a leader who, for whatever reason, his board or his team or his church board or elders or somebody's, they're really concerned about this guy. He needs help. You know, let's call Bill. You know, if I'm the one they call, there's several people they can call. And I'll say to them, if they call me, I'll say, okay, I want to meet him. And then I'll say to them, and if he agrees to let me, I want you to know that I will only work with him in the context of his leadership team and the board. I will not isolate him from you. Hmm. Because his problems are you. And they'll go, what? Say that again in English? We want you to help him. I am helping him.
They wish they called somebody else.
Exactly.
At that point.
I'm saying, no, I am helping him. I'm helping him by helping him understand that unless you guys, his leadership team, whatever you call that, and his board, understand the critical role you play in who he is becoming. So I'll say that to him. So when I meet with these leaders, and some of them agree, some don't. But I'll meet with them, and I'll say to them, hey, thanks for coming. Let's have a little couple hours this afternoon. I get to know you. But let me kind of start this with two questions for you to ponder this afternoon. First question is this. Are you at a place where you're willing to let somebody help you? Yeah. That's my first question. Are you at that place? Because at that place, you need to decide if you're willing to earn my trust. Second question is this. Are you willing to let somebody help you, but not on your terms?
Mm-hmm.
they'll look at me like,
check, please.
Exactly. Exactly. Because I'll say to them, what we want to do in our relationship is model what I hope will happen with you and your key leaders. See, so they look at me and they go, oh, man. And it's been actually, I'm not bragging, but it's been quite successful.
And in answer to my question, you're actually inviting them into this humility
exactly,
of trusting you.
Exactly. Yeah. In my relationship with them.
Yeah, creating a context for it
exactly.
to happen.
Exactly. The guy I went quail hunting with, I told you about this week.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys.
Okay. That's got to be very messy. In
yes.
a good way.
No, it's very, very messy.
As opposed to here's the formula. Here's how to do it.
Yeah, I met with, doesn't make which Christian college, but a large Christian college's president was in crisis with his board and all the good stuff. And I met with his cabinet. And I said to them, here's some material that's just a tool. But I have a question for you. Do you trust your board? Write it down. What hinders you from trusting your board? Write it down. Make it personal. Okay. Well, I look, point to him. I said, you trust him? Write it down. I look at each other. You trust each other? What hinders it? Why don't you do that? They all just went. You could just feel the freeze in the room. I mean, it was heavy freeze. And I said, write them all down. Now put them away. We're not going to talk about them yet. I just want to prove the point. The point is, you guys need to learn, how to build and restore trust with him. Hmm. And then after we did all that, we went through some training, and then I sat with he and his board, same question. Hmm. I mean, at the board level, it surprised me, because the board buy-in was quicker than the cabinet's buy-in. Hmm. I mean, they were all over it. So I'm saying all of that's complicated response, but the point is that our leaders have been taught how to lead. They haven't been taught how to trust. Hmm. And they haven't been taught how to be trusted. And when they don't know that, there's no way that ultimately anybody can stand with them. Hmm. And if a leader doesn't learn to let somebody stand with him, he is doomed for failure. And his failure will repeat itself everywhere he goes.
Hmm. And that brings us back to grace without grace, which is one of the, in the ascent of a leader, there's the picture of the ladder.
Yes.
One of the sides of the ladder is the environment of grace.
Yes. Yeah.
And so without grace, trusting is foolish.
It can't happen.
Right.
It can't happen because often we as Christians are the most schizophrenic of all people. We know Christ has something really significant in us, and we really want to be known. But because of our shame stories, we're afraid we will be. So we live in the crisis of the of the unknown. Hmm. You know, in 1 John, we're invited to walk in the light. Ephesians chapter 5, we're invited to walk in the light. Well, the light is that biblical place where nothing is hidden. You can't hide in the light. Hmm. Well, so sometimes we read those scriptures and we create an ought to. I ought to walk in the light. No. There's a reason you can walk in the light. You've been made new.
Hmm.
You ain't who you used to be. You've been made new. You have been made righteous and holy. Throughout all of the scriptures, holiness and light are inseparable. And I'm invited of God not to work at getting into the light. I'm invited because of what Christ did in me to be in the light with God. And in that passage in 1 John, it's so hard. It sounds so contradictory to many Christians. He's invited us to walk in the light, and then he tells us those who walk in the light will sin. And if you say you don't sin, you're a liar.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, wait, that can't be true. I mean, I'm either one or the other. Mm-hmm. No, I'm both. See, I'm both. But if I can't walk in the light, because I don't believe I should walk in the light, I will try to manage my sin so I can function in the light rather than seeing it. It's only in the place of light where I can deal with my sin. That's, Mike, that's a huge, huge difference. And in my mind, it's the only thing that makes 1 John make sense.
Mm-hmm. And the whole sin management, you use that, Dallas Willard has used that phrase. It's something that it's a false kind of hope that we can be good enough, but it also keeps us from the very thing that we want.
Exactly.
Which is to be loved for who we are.
Exactly. It's interesting. When Adam and Eve first sinned, very first sin, they sewed together fig leaves. That was the first act of sin management. Man felt obligated to do something about the fact he had sinned. And a friend of ours named Tom, years ago, he said to me, you know, Bill, your fig leaves aren't covering as much as you think they are. But you see, what happened is sin management is a theology that is rooted in law. Because it's a theology that says, I can do something about my sin by working on it. That's a principle of law. Now, what the principle of law does is the principle of law was written by God to convince me that I am unrighteous. Yeah. Working on the principle of law will never produce righteousness in me. Yeah. It'll only continue to reveal the unrighteousness that I have. So sin management literally keeps me preoccupied with sin and devoid of relationship. Yeah. Grace brings me into relationship. So there is a basis from which I can deal with my sin. Again, it's one of those huge misunderstandings and almost contradictions in the scripture. Yeah.
And yet it's a huge distinction.
Oh,
that each of those is a different path.
A different path. That's why we have the book, True Faced.
Yeah.
That's why we have the two paths.
Tell me about that. I've read True Faced. Some of the people who would hear this may not have heard of it or read it, but what's the heart of the message of True Faced?
Yeah. Again, I'll back up a little bit. When we were first working with this triad of humility, relationships of trust, and environments of grace, our focus was leaders. But we realized that a majority of our audience never saw themselves as leaders, even if they were in leadership positions. So we wrote a book called True Faced that we would say we've written to readers. That's anybody. Principles of Grace written to readers. And the whole basis for that book is this reality. Can I trust who God says I am? Can I trust that? The miracle of Calvary is that God made me new. Can I believe that? What if we as Christians actually dared to believe we're already righteous? What if Jesus, when he said, the world will know my disciples because you love one another, a new commandment I give you. What if he was teaching, the theology of Jesus was teaching this? Under the law, you could not become righteous because you were unrighteous. But you can obey this commandment because you're righteous. See, Jesus never taught this, ever. Nowhere in his theology are these words. The world will know you are my disciples because you sin less than they do. That's never in the theology of Jesus. He knows better.
Right.
So, righteousness is not measured by how little I sin.
It's measured by the presence of something.
It's by the presence of love. It's measured by the world would know you're my disciples because you love one another. So what we did in True Faced is we create an allegory in which the person in the book comes across these paths, one leading pleasing God to the room of good intentions, and one trusting God leading to the room of grace. And we describe the behavior patterns of people who, with all the good intentions in the world, not understanding grace, will strive like crazy to figure out the Christian life. And we have a banner in the back of the room, and it says, working on my sin so I can have an intimate relationship with God. That's in the back room. You know, and there's only a bazillion Christians doing that this moment while we're talking. In the room of grace, it says, my God standing beside me with my sin in front of us. See, so often, again, these are just subtle things, Mike, but so often we believe that we need to do something about our sin so we can be presentable to God, and he becomes our last resort instead of our first resort. What if I just saw him for what he says is true. I tease people when I say this to them publicly. I wonder what God meant when he said, I will never leave you or forsake you. I wonder what he meant. Everybody says, well, he'll never leave us or forsake us, but you don't believe that. See, some of you believe that you can go sin and leave God on the curb. I want you to know he goes with you. Because he'll never leave you. See, it blew the minds of the Pharisees that Jesus could go into the house of the sinners, the harlots, and the publicans. And so we say, well, God wouldn't do that because he's holy. No, it's because he's holy, he can do it.
Say more about that. That, again, holiness, it sounds like where you might go with that is that holiness is not about the absence of sin, but the presence of love.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's the presence of light. Okay. Think of righteousness and love. Think of holiness and light. Where when Jesus would go into that place of darkness, it lit up. He didn't become dark. They had light shed on them. And when I say that, I mean, sometimes I'll have young leaders, because one of our audiences, our next generation leaders, they look at me and say, man, I can't believe I've taken Jesus into those places. Yeah, well, what did he tell you? What do you think he meant? I'll never leave you. Oh, I can't believe that. Well, try believing it. It'll change when you go there if you know Jesus is with you. Mm-hmm. If it's so comfortable to leave him on the curb, I say to the guys, if you went to a strip joint, it's so easy to imagine Jesus on the curb. It's a lot harder to imagine him sitting next to you at the bar. Mm-hmm. No, I don't want to think that thought. No, that's the thought you should think.
Yeah.
Because that's where he is.
Yeah. And even in that place, the presence of love.
Exactly. Yeah. So back to true faith. So our goal in that was to say to people, do you know what? In the room of grace, our relationships were the worst of you can be known, and you'll be loved more for it. In that scenario, the power of sin is always broken. The power of sin is always served in the principle of law. That's what Romans teaches us. But we don't believe my next statement, which is not mine, it's God's. But you're not under law anymore. Yeah. You're under grace. The principle of law is no longer the principle that you serve, because you're no longer unrighteous. Yeah. Oh my gosh, what if I believe that? We sat with a Christian leader in my home, in fact, Bruce and I and two other guys, and he really, we were having dinner, lunch, and he was sitting at the end of the table. And he looked up with tears in his eyes. He said, guys, do you understand? If I believe that, everything would change. Mm. And we said, well, everything's been changed. You just have to believe it. Mm. Powerful message, Mike.
It's a powerful message. And we both encounter people all the time, and organizations and bodies and churches filled with people that don't hear that.
They don't hear it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I told you just last month, we were at this pastor's conference, and I'm going to guess there were 300 pastors and families and wives and whatever in husbands, because this was a denomination where women were pastors. So it was husbands and wives. And we were taking them through what we call our true-faced intensive, where we have these principles of grace that we're trying to help people understand. If you can grasp the essence of these 12, it'll help you. And at first, they're just kind of, what in the world? Who brought these guys in? But almost without exception, every time, we usually do a late afternoon, evening, and then all day the next day. Not everybody, I couldn't say that, but a majority of them by the middle of the next morning are raising questions and revealing brokenness. Because this is one of the statements we teach. I know you've heard me say it many times, and that is, if my theology doesn't touch my reality, it's because I don't understand grace. Mm-hmm. Grace always touches our reality. That's why there's a place called Calvary. Because at a place called Calvary, God touched my reality. I needed a Savior. But I also need to be made new. And that's what he did. He touched my reality. And we don't believe that. Then what happens is we will it's a natural propensity, like in the garden, for man to fill the gap until he's convinced God can. That's just our natural propensity. We will fill the gap until we're convinced God can. Hmm. That's it. That's the way we live. And so we have a bazillion well-meaning Christians who've got 10,000 books out there on how to do something. You know, I heard a person very, very well, very, very well known in the arena of spiritual disciplines. And he stood before some of us one day and he said, I used to lie until I disciplined my tongue, and I no longer lie. And people were politely clapping, and I was getting ready to throw up. And I said, you just lied. What do you mean you no longer lie? What are you telling us? Because listen carefully. If sin could be managed apart from the cross, you don't need Jesus. If a person who was a liar could stop lying without a redemptive process, Jesus died for every sin because I cannot manage any sin.
And we're so good at deceiving ourselves.
Oh.
And that's, I mean, when you say you just lied, is that we deceive ourselves into really believing that there's been a change.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there is change. Change does happen.
Right.
I mean, it does happen. We are able. I mean, you have your life story. I have my life story. You know, I mean, AA works. Mm-hmm. It does work. I mean, people's behaviors do change.
Right.
But we're not talking about behavior change. He didn't die to create a behavior change in us.
What's the path that you've walked as a younger man? You're how old today?
72.
You're 72.
Yeah.
You look great. I would not have guessed that you're 72.
I'm 72.
You've been following Christ for decades, I presume.
Yeah.
You were a pastor. You're a consultant in business settings. What's the path that you've walked that's brought you to this awareness?
Well, first of all, unfortunately, it begins in brokenness. My family, my mother and father, were both alcoholics, pretty sick when I was a young kid. And the state of Wisconsin took us away from our parents.
Mm.
And I had to live with my younger brother and sister in a children's home. Mm. I remember vividly my brother and I was about 7 or 8. He was 5 or 6. And we thought that they'd put us in jail, that we had done something wrong. We couldn't figure out what we had done. And all the time we were there, our parents never visited us. So we didn't know if we were ever coming home.
Mm.
In fact, I was in the hospital while I was there, and nobody came to see me. I mean, it was just like, this is not good.
Heartbreaking.
Not real smart, but this is not good. So that what happened is both of my parents, in their alcoholism, and quite honestly, I hate to say this, but in their sexuality, they were compulsive. And in that compulsiveness, they trained us well, and we were all compulsive children.
Mm.
And it just had a variety of expressions. Interesting, there's 9 children. The oldest sister, younger brother had passed away, but none of the 9 of us were alcoholics, but we're all compulsive.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is I didn't know, Mike, I didn't have a clue. I was just growing up. I knew I was a lonely, miserable kid. I knew that. You know, I love working with high school and college kids. I used to give a talk to high school kids. I love to give this talk. I still give it once in a while. Some church will still ask me, not as much, of course. I'm in my 70s, for crying out loud. But I'd say to the kids, I know you cannot wait until you're able to do whatever you want. I know you can't wait. You just can't wait for your parents to be gone so you can do whatever you want. I said, I never had a parent tell me no. I could do anything I wanted from the time I was 7 years old. And I want to tell you have no idea what it's like to live without boundaries. You have no idea how afraid I was. You have no idea how insecure I was. You have no idea how not enough I was. Don't wish for something that'll damn you. I give that talk. I mean, kids just sit there going, oh, shucks. But but that beginning... I don't mean this to sound proud, but I was smart. So I had an advantage over a couple of my siblings because I was smart. So what I did is I learned to navigate because of my smartness through the systems of education and social settings better than they did.
Okay.
But I was just as screwed up and dysfunctional as anybody in my family, except my sisters, I think, got the worst of it all. So I'm in Bible college. I become a Christian at 17. 6 weeks later, I'm in Bible college. And I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm just, back, this is way back in the 50s, and I've got ducktails and a flat top and a leather jacket, and these kids, some of them had never been away from home for more than 20 minutes. I mean, you talk about
culture shock.
Oh, man, for them, I was the weirdest person they knew so far. But anyway, and I don't even know how we knew this. I don't know that, except one of the older students, a guy had been in the Navy for a while. I was 17. He was 27. He came up to me one day and he said, "Can I talk to you about something?" "Sure. What would you like to talk about?" I said, "Well," he said, "I want to talk to you about it, but I want to give you some advice." His name was Jerry. "Sure, Jerry. Well, tell me anything you want. You know, what do I know?" He said, "I've been watching you. I don't mean this to, I'm not haunted, but, but I want you to know I've been watching you." He said, "I'd like to recommend that you don't date anybody for a couple of years." He said, I think you have some pretty unhealthy attitudes and views of women." Oh, my gosh. I just started bawling. How would anybody know that? And I was dying in that reality.
It resonated.
I mean, to the nth degree. Because I was already at that time at Bible college. I was 15. A friend of mine's dad was an entertainer and had sex books and movies that were made in Hollywood that, I mean, we could watch it. I was already addicted to pornography at 17. Mm. And it lasted way up into my marriage. That was the expression of my compulsiveness. I thought it was going to be in gambling because I was so stinking good at cards. I thought, oh man, if I'm going to be compulsive anywhere, it's going to be because we gamble. I know I tell people this and they laugh with me. My mother loved to play cards, but she would not play cards with us even as kids unless we played for money.
Wow.
Really, I would lose my paperboy route money to my mother playing cards.
The stakes were high.
Because she said, "You don't play cards for fun." He says, "You play Monopoly for fun. You play cards for real."
That's great.
She taught me how to gamble. She was good.
It's a little more socially acceptable addiction.
And so I went to college after Bible college, and Grace and I got married, and God graced me with an incredible wife whose name is Grace. And 5 years into our marriage, she one day took me for a drive to tell me she was extremely unhappy in our marriage. I've been a Christian 10 years. And I tell you, talk about God using somebody in your life. And she said to me, "Would you like to know why I'm unhappy?" And I said, "Sure, of course." And she said, "Bill, we can't continue to live in a relationship where only you get to love me. Why won't you let me love you? Why can't you trust me?" And I had never put trust and love together. I desperately wanted, I was doing everything I could to please this girl. I thought I was the greatest husband in the world, and she was miserable, and I couldn't even figure it out.
Wow.
And that night, for the first time in my life, I trusted somebody with who I was. And I shared the whole garbage list with her. And I was so stinking self-righteous. When I got to the gross stuff, I thought to myself, if she were telling me this, I'd kick her out of the car. And I was the one that was screwed up. And she just kept loving me. Once in a while, she'd pause to say, "Why do you do that?" She said, "That's really weird." I said, "No, thanks. Welcome to my world." But there wasn't any, first time in my life ever, I experienced what it was like to be clean. I'd never had that feeling since a child, ever. And my wife forgave me. I felt forgiven. Later, I had to learn to forgive myself, and she wasn't my counselor. But that was the breaking point in the preparation of my life for the message of grace. A few years after that, we started a ministry with a bunch of hippies. I'm this right-wing Goldwaterite CPA guy, and I got all these long-haired guys and mostly clothed girls, you know, hanging around. I mean, Mike, it wasn't unusual for me to come home from work and have people in the front yard, backyard, and every room in the house waiting for me to come home.
Wow.
And Grace and I sat down on a Friday afternoon. Neither one of us will ever forget it, ever. And we just started crying at our table. And we just said, it's time, isn't it? We got to go into the ministry with these kids.
Wow. Was that the start of the church?
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't the start. It was the start of our outreach ministry.
Okay.
We didn't plan to start a church. We were all about evangelism. And God, it was the hippie. It was the Jesus movement. I could take 2 hours to tell you about all that. It was wonderfully, horribly hard and great. But we weren't going to start a church because we wanted to have the fruit of our ministry go back to the churches. But the churches couldn't take the fruit of our ministry. And rock and roll, you know, I mean, all of that was just, at that time, the church had no sensitivity to. And so a bunch of them, about 15 of them on a Sunday morning, we sent them to a big Bible church in town. And when we got to, they were in the parking lot, the girls were crying and the elders wouldn't let them in.
Oh.
So we went to our house, Grace and I and these 15 young adults that we had seen come to Christ, a couple of young leaders. And we said, maybe we should start a church. If there's a more naive group that ever started a church, I haven't met them. And what we did is we took butcher paper and put it all over the living room walls. And the first thing we did is, what should church not be like? And we created a, can't be like that. What would it be like? And we started to form an idea from the scriptures purely. And no, I have no training in church building.
Wow.
And so we started a church, and it bore the fruit of our outreach ministry. And that's where we started to nurture people. And that's where I got in touch with, this is how it happened to me. My audience became my teacher. Hmm. I was a communicator. I'd been talking a lot. I mean, even back then I was, you know, in my early 30s, but I'd been doing a lot of talks for Campus Crusade and a lot of talks for Christian Business. So I was a communicator, but I'd never been a pastor. Mm-hmm. So we had a very unusual Sunday morning. You could talk to me while I was preaching.
Wow.
You could interrupt me and ask me what it meant and we were studying it. And so a lot of times on a Sunday morning, I never got through a message. Didn't have to. They were my message. But they taught me a lot, Mike. And what they taught me was this question constantly came up. Bill, what difference does it make in the way we live from what you're teaching us? Why would we learn this if it doesn't have something to do with the way we live? And I realized that the core of my theology had no application, like none.
Wow.
And God used that audience to teach me how to make grace experiential. Because when grace is just cognitive, it's one of our theologies. When it's experiential, it's foundational. That's how it started. I mean, it was just, and I guess it trapped my gifting, and it got me going, and we lived in those principles. That was the way we lived. We came up with essentials that would guide our behaviors with each other. One of our essentials still is this essential. We're for, not against.
Hmm. It's so easy to be against things, isn't it?
We're for, not against.
Yeah, requires grace.
We realize that being for something, there others might be against us. But there is no anti, in those days, no anti-charismatic. There's no anti-this, no anti-that. We're for something. Now, that requires a very different set of learning.
Hmm. It's striking how the very things you talked about in that early stage of your marriage, when things were hard, how that so closely parallels, you were trying so hard to please your wife and failing miserably, and how you write about in True Faced, and so much of what you speak of is how we try so hard to please God.
Exactly. And all,
when
he,
he's
wants,
already pleased
and all
with
he
us.
Wants us to do is trust him.
Yeah.
So he can what? Love us.
Yeah.
It's too simple.
Yeah.
But it's so profound. And so that little sketch of the history of our beginning, one more real quick story. I don't remember the date. I don't remember. Sometime late 90s. I mean, late 80s. Can't remember when, but it's not important. I was asked to speak at a large missions conference in Brookfield, Wisconsin, Brookfield Church. I don't know, 500-600 people. It was both an embarrassing and a wonderful experience. So I got up to teach. And when I got all done, nobody moved. Nobody said anything. Nobody came up to tell me what to do next. And a man stood up in the second row, big man. Found out later he was the publisher of Multnomah Press, and he stood up and he said to me, "Who are you? Where did you get this message? We've never heard this before." And I went, "No kidding, you guys. It was that dramatic." I went, "No kidding. This is what we learned. This is what we teach. This is who we are." And he said, "I've never heard it before."
Wow.
Wow. So that was one of those oh my goshes.
It's so often the gospel that we claim is good news is a kind of gospel that isn't good news at all.
Yeah.
And there's a whole other gospel that really is good news.
Yeah.
I want to come back to a topic we were talking a little bit about on the way up the elevator before this interview, and that is I want to talk about Bo's Cafe.
Yeah.
And you talked about how there was an audience that was discovered that you called the de-churched.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the de-churched.
It's a painful audience for us to talk about, Mike, because Bo's Cafe was a book that many of our readers were asking for, and that was, tell us how to live this Room of Grace life. And so we felt the best way to do it was with a novel. Let's do it with a story. The people aren't real, but they're real. I mean, we know who our characters are. We've lived with these people. But nobody would know that. And what happened was the book, through our publisher, was distributed to an audience that was very familiar with the book The Shack. And that audience, millions of people, but a huge majority, more than we imagined of that audience, were de-churched people, not unchurched, de-churched people, people who had been to church and found the church so lacking, often for their lives destructive. Some of them would tell you that their greatest hurts came in their church setting. And many of them started sending us emails. They were really upset with us because they were saying, how can you teach these principles of creating safe places and be church guys? You can't be church guys. You can't do both. Church is not safe. Hmm. So your book is contradictory to us. And, you know, if there had been 100 of them, I'm telling you, Mike, there are hundreds of thousands of de-church people. As a pastor, my heart, I'm so concerned for them because they're without leadership. They're so vulnerable to the doctrines and nonsense of angry people. See, angry people do not have healthy theology. And so you have this huge, back to that statement of for, not against, you have a huge anti-church movement in America led by angry people, which keeps people bound in their nonsense. It's so troubling to us. So our best answer to all of them is, if you can't start with somebody. Find somebody that's safe enough for you to be known. And that's why we have that table at Bo's Cafe, as you know, that where it's safe enough for our lead character in the book and his wife to finally come to grips with his dysfunctions and hers.
Right.
And I was speaking at an international leaders meeting a couple of weeks ago, and one of the men was from Germany, and he said, "Oh, I know who you are, Bo's Cafe." He said, "We have it in German." I said, "Really?" Oh, he says, "I give them out like candy." And I said, "Really? That's great." I thought, what must Bo's Cafe be like in German with all our idioms and a little place on the wharf in California? How does that translate into German? I don't have a clue, but he's excited about it.
That's great.
Yeah. So Bo's Cafe has proven to be a book that actually it led us, after Bo's Cafe, it led us into our new book, which is coming out really soon, called The Cure, in which we've taken the first part of True Faced into the rooms, the two rooms, and from that expanded it into the application of life. And it's called The Cure. And our goal each time is to say this. This is our conviction. The three of us as authors, and we work very close together. This is our conviction that God is trusting us with the stewardship of a message of grace. And our job is to figure out as well as we can, as often as we can, in a variety of forms we can, how to let these principles of truth be known. That's our life mission. That's what we do. That's what we do. And it's just our conviction. I mean, that's what drives us. And so everything we try to write, speak to, address is to be as consistent as we can, laying that foundation of grace so I can live out of who I am. We have a little paradigm, a little model, a little construct of two lines representing lifelines. One is my life and sin issues, and the other is my trusting God with who I am. And for a majority of Christians, they want to work on their sins so they become godly. And our model is now come to grips with who you are so you can work on your sin.
Hmm. Wow. Back to the Boats Cafe. And we just have a couple more minutes, I know, of your time.
Right.
I was working with a man, missionary overseas in Eastern Europe. And had some very deep brokenness in his life, and he was finally coming to terms with that. Mm. And I gave him a copy of Bo's Cafe, and he came back in the next day, and his eyes were filled with tears. Mm. And he said he was angry at me. Mm-hmm. And he was deeply, deeply moved by the book. He was not de-churched by virtue of the fact that he was in ministry, but he said, this seems too good to be true.
Right.
He said, I don't believe this exists anywhere.
Yeah.
What would you say to the person, whether they're in ministry or just the, quote, normal Christian, who has been burned by the church or who has tried to seek out even a person who's mm-hmm. not a paid therapist? What would you say to that person? Mm. How can you create or find that kind of a safe, mm-hmm. grace-filled community?
Yeah. Well, I think I would say a couple things to them. One thing I would say to them is, what is it you need to learn about grace so you can become the initiator? In other words, I would give it right back to them, and I would say, what do you need to learn about grace that would free you to be someone that can be trusted? Hmm. Because if you can learn that, then you will be the one that becomes safe for someone else. And once you find that person for which you can be safe, you will find that they are safe. See, so it's like, don't start a process that you yourself yet are not ready to live in.
Okay.
And it's okay. It's okay to say to them. And they'll look at me and they'll go, oh, I don't know what you mean. I don't know what you mean. I say, well, let's go back to something real practical. In both True Faced and in Bo's Cafe, we have a guide. Go back to the guide, answer the questions for you. Start with you. Invite a friend to go through the process of answering the questions together. Invite a friend. If you don't have a friend, invite a stranger. Just find somebody, and you can just say to them, I don't know where this is going to take us. In fact, we have a guy who just spoke at this pastor's conference for us, and that's how he started. He just said he's got more courage than most people. But he went to some of his colleagues and he said, I don't know where this is going to take us, but would you be willing to dare?
Wow.
Going through a process where we might learn trust. Mm. And four guys started with him. One guy dropped out and it's changed all their lives. So sometimes what people do is they say, well, I don't have anybody. And I'll say to them, but you're the one who needs to be that somebody. You're right, you don't have anybody, but neither is anybody else.
Yeah.
So what if you were so convicted that you became that somebody? And they'll go, oh, that's hard. Let me give you another principle of grace. Grace is free. But to one who's giving it, it's always sacrificial. Hmm. Welcome to the real world of faith.
Yeah, it all requires faith.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Bill, what is the website? A central place where people can go for resources?
It's pretty simple right now. It's trueface.com.
Okay.
And that's who we are, and that's where you can go and find out. That's our website, and go find out about us and what we do and what we don't do. And that'll give you access. You can get on our mailing list. It'll give you access to our materials. It'll give you access to us. You can get on blog. We'll invite you to our blog. The three of us do a blog every week.
Okay.
And we talk through these principles together. We just do a 10 to 12 minute blog. It'll give them access to the blog. It'll give them access to our Facebook. And They can interact with us. John loves it. He's on it a couple hours a day. I avoid it like the plague. It's just too technical for me. I'm just, thank you very much. I know you love me, but I ain't going to do that. But I sneak into it once in a while. I'll take a peek, but I'm not.
Okay.
That's not who I am.
And when you're referring to us, the three of us, it's John Lynch, it's Bruce McNichol, and you,
yes.
co-authored together,
right.
Bose Cafe, True Faced, and you and Bruce, The Ascent of a Leader.
Right.
And together you make up Leadership Catalyst.
That's right. And our new book, The Cure.
The Cure, that's right. Yeah. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mike.
It's a blessing,
Good
as
to
always.
Be with you.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
So thank you for listening to another episode of Restoring the Soul. We want you to know that Restoring the Soul is so much more than a podcast. What we're all about is helping couples and individuals get unstuck. You know how some people go to counseling or marriage therapy for months or even years and never really get anywhere? Our intensive programs help clients get unstuck in as little as 2 weeks. To learn more, visit RestoringTheSoul.com. That's RestoringTheSoul.com.